Right now, on Last Call, a major development in the Middle East, and it has oil prices popping. It's back. Could hot inflation deflate President Biden's re-election bid? New data you've got to see. Waving ta-ta to tech. Why a major Wall Street bank says it's time for you to move on from some of these red-hot stocks. An unnerving hire. The mess for Boeing and its suppliers taking an even stranger turn. Plus, shareholder backlash mounting against one potential Paramount offer. Are investors about to get hosed in Hollywood? And teeing up the Masters getting underway tomorrow. And there's one sleeper pick gaining buzz to win it all. Literally never heard of the guy. But we're going to find out who it is. All that and more over the hour. So tee up or buckle up. Last Call is up right now. Well, good evening here. Good afternoon out west. I'm Brian Sullivan. All that and more. Hard to believe in just 1 hour. But first up right now on Last Call, President Biden doubling down on his call that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates this year. Now, it came even after another data point showing inflation going back up. But here's what the president said at the White House earlier today.
I do stand by my prediction that before the year is out, there'll be a rate cut. This may delay it a month or so. I'm not sure of that. We don't know what the Fed is going to do for certain.
Now, his comments come almost a month to the day after he made these memorable remarks in Pennsylvania.
Guess what? I can't guarantee it, but I bet you those rates come down more because I bet you that that little outfit that sets interest rates, it's going to come down.
Now, the president's Twitter account, X, also tweeting today, quote, today's data showing inflation has fallen over 60% from its peak, but we have more to do to lower costs. Now, that's taking a percentage change on a percentage change from the COVID peak, not really normally how it's looked at, but hey, anyway, today data showed that inflation is still going up, folks. You know that. I don't have to tell you that. The rate of price increases is thankfully coming down. But make no mistake, prices for most things, inflation, are going up, not down. Not my opinion, it's the data. And today, Jason Furman, who, by the way, is the former Council of Economic Advisors chair under President Obama, laid it out on X, quote, over the last 3 months, core CPI has risen at a 4.6% annual rate. That is faster than any three-month period from August 1991 to 2020. The hot pace of inflation made investors more nervous than a cat in a room filled with rocking chairs. Stocks fell across the board, though they did end off their lows. So with inflation up, interest rates spiking, the 2- and 10-year Treasury yields hitting their highest levels in more than 4 months, which means borrowing costs, car loans, mortgages are probably going to tick back up. Hey, don't blame the messenger. Tom Lee is Fundstrat managing partner and head of research and a CNBC contributor. Tom, love having you on. Don't need to remind you, but I will. The last time you were here, you said this.
By the time the Fed meets in June, there's going to be a total of 3 inflation reports, March, April, May. I think by then, markets are going to be a lot more confident that inflation is falling and the 3 cuts actually may be too low. You know, there's a possibility there's more than 3 cuts this year.
So Tom, has this report, it's just one, and PCE could go down, but has this report changed your views?
Well, Brian, as we know, the Fed is data dependent. So they're watching these reports. The markets are expecting the Fed to react to these. And so it is going to push out the probability of a June cut. But that being said, I don't think this entirely eliminates the possibility of a June cut. It just makes so much more weight now on the April CPI report and the May, and those are still 2 months ahead.
Yeah, and listen, I'm sort of thinking more no rate cuts. That's just me. But as my trusty producer, who you know well, Max, reminded me, Jay Powell, the Fed chair himself, has effectively kind of said we're probably going to get one. We just ran the president's, not to be political, but the president effectively hinting, nudging, whatever, that we're going to get one. Maybe it's silly to bet against that, looking at the data, but the people that actually make the decisions in the Fed are saying we might get one.
I think it makes sense to expect a rate cut, only because if the Fed's notion of a neutral rate is, 2.5% or even 3%, we're at 5.3%, then the Fed is running very restrictive monetary policy. And when you look at their summary economic projections, they're, we only need a few basis points of unemployment increase to hit what they expect to happen this year. And PCE, which, as you mentioned, is the Fed's preferred measure, it's not expected to hit 2% this year. It's supposed to track towards 2.5%, and it's, potentially it's 2.7% when we get that in 2 weeks. So it's, I think we're tracking there. So I think it would be difficult for the Fed to sort of turn hawkish at a time when a lot of the sort of benchmarks they're using are actually tracking towards what they expect.
And we know that you've been very bullish on small caps. A lot of that has to do with the Fed. You're sticking to that, so I imagine you're sticking with the small cap thing.
Yes, that's right. It's not a good day for our thesis because, as you know, today's CPI report raised questions about whether inflation is in fact improving. We think it is. So there is a perception divergence that hopefully benefits small caps, because ultimately, if the Fed is dovish, this is really good for small caps. Small caps have a median earnings growth of 19% versus 11%. Earnings season starting soon. And the median PE is 10 times versus almost 16 times for the S&P. So I think you've got a good risk reward on small caps. But again, not a great day because of the March CPI report.
No, and listen, again, one data point. We get the PCE, the Fed's preferred measure. We'll see what happens. But, Tom Lee, you remember Rocky, right? Rocky 2. I don't want to ruin it for anybody if they haven't seen it yet. Where Rocky wins and Apollo's corner is like basically begging him to, stop fighting because Rocky's going to come back and knock him out or whatever. I just ruined the movie for a lot of people. It's 50 years old. And they're like, throw in the towel. Like, when does Tom Lee throw in the towel? Cut me, Mick. Like, when does that moment happen?
Well, today isn't really a day I think that investors should give up the idea inflation's improving. I know the report on the headline basis and core didn't look great because core came in at 0.36. But what might surprise your viewers is that if you look at the percentage of CPI components, the percentage that had a 3% or less inflation rate hit 36%. That's the highest since 2021. So directionally, the underlying internals of the CPI basket are showing a move towards under 3%. But the headline's being held up and the core is being held because of housing and auto insurance. And as many may be aware, auto insurance is actually going through its own mini cycle of repricing. It's not something the Fed can control through interest rates to control that, the rate of insurance inflation.
That's a good point. Tom Lee sticking to the guns. We'll wait and see what happens. He lost in Rocky and then he won in Rocky too. I ruined it. I know. Tom Lee, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, let's take a look at what happened inside the markets. And your stud and dud. Well, the big winner of the day is GE Vernova. That is the new energy unit spun out of GE last week. That is staying as hot as inflation. The big decliner inside the S&P, shoe company Deckers Outdoor, down 6.5%, downgraded over demand concerns for products like the Hoka running shoe. Hoka running shoe makes you like 2 inches taller, by the way. Let's get a quick check on futures. They are all pointing slightly lower at the moment. All right, we are just getting started. And up next, oil on the rise again as U.S. production falls and tension with Iran rises, plus cashing out of tech. Why one big Wall Street bank says you might just want to move on, ghost them, and go somewhere else. We'll talk about it. Get to tomorrow's news tonight, or as we call it, the news before the news. First up, a big deal biggie. According to Politico, the Justice Department has opened a formal antitrust investigation into Japan's Nippon Steel's planned buyout of U.S. Steel. President Biden has said he's against the deal, and he's been meeting the last couple of days with Japan's prime minister while he visits Washington. Well, today, the Department of Justice opened an investigation. Shares for U.S. Steel remain relatively flat in trading right now. Next up, more concern is building around a potential Iranian attack in the Middle East. Bloomberg reporting that the U.S. now believes major missile or drone strikes on Israel are imminent. It would come from either Iran or one of its proxies. Today, German airline Lufthansa suspending flights to and from Tehran. Suspension currently lasts until Thursday, but the airline monitoring the situation. Oil prices have remained firm the last couple of weeks as warnings of a potential attack become more urgent. How would an Iranian attack on Israel further impact oil markets? And do we have to worry about American oil production going down even as tensions heat up? Joining us tonight is Liberty Energy CEO Chris Wright. Chris, listen, Israel obviously is not an oil producer. I get that. But Iran, they do something. Does the world then take some kind of an action? Do we start reinforcing sanctions on Iran? How closely are you watching that situation?
Oh, definitely watching it, Brian. Because look, we've got sanctions on Russia, sanctions on Iran, but all the oil is still flowing. All the oil is still flowing. So if Iran is in a hot war with Israel and that thing heats up, Iranian oil probably doesn't all flow. And yeah, the market, you see oil prices are firm today, pricing in some of this risk. So definitely watching what happens in the Middle East, and particularly the flow of oil.
Yeah, the flow in Iran is threatening. They sort of made this threat. We covered it last night about the Strait of Hormuz, which is maybe the most critical oil choke point in the world, with 20% of the world's oil and liquid commodities rolling through that. I want to point out something that's not getting a lot of attention, and it's 1 month, and I hate 1 month trends, Chris, but U.S. oil production was ostensibly on paper at a record October, November, December, at about 13.2 million barrels a day. I know some say the numbers may not be as accurate as they need to be, but you get my point. The number, though, for January was 12.5 million. So we saw about a 700,000 to 800,000 barrel per day drop in January. I get it. It's cold. It's the holidays. But are you expect, this is what you do for a living, are you expecting U.S. oil production to decline?
No. Yeah, 1 month. I think that's bad weather. That's some noise in the data. Activity has slowed down enough today that oil production is probably on a pretty flattish trend right now. Natural gas production actually is on a downward trend. But oil, I expect to see it flattish over the next several months and probably through most of this year. When you add in natural gas liquids, probably a little growth by year end, but not the breakneck pace of growth we've seen for many years over the last decade.
What's amazing is that crude oil is at 86. Okay, now I know Mexico, they just had a fire offshore. Pemex also diverting some of its exports, a couple hundred thousand barrels a day. But Brazil's at record production. They're probably going to 4 million barrels. Iran, we talked about them. They're fully and freely selling oil on the global market once again. Iraq is at 4+. Russia continues to sell. I know OPEC's taking 2 million barrels a day on paper off the market. Are you surprised that oil's at 86 bucks?
No, I think it's reasonably reflecting continued growth. Demand for oil and gas today is at record highs. There is spare capacity in Saudi Arabia. You know, that's what I think the consumers of the world have to be thankful for. If we're sitting here 18 months or 2 years from now, and Saudi has brought that spare production capacity back on, you know, it'll be $130 a barrel today instead of $86 a barrel today. But there still is some cushion supply in the system today.
Thankfully, thanks to the American oil complex, guys like you and plenty of people out there in Texas and North Dakota and New Mexico doing the hard work and some bad weather. And we do appreciate it. Chris Wright of Liberty, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Meantime, Goldman Sachs Asset Management is apparently over some tech stocks, suggesting you take your gains and move on. The firm telling Bloomberg, quote, "We like taking profits on technology and moving toward other sectors," adding that right now in the tech industry, quote, "the risk reward profile is skewed to the downside." And GSAM, as it is known, apparently suggesting investments in areas like what we just talked about, energy instead of technology. So is it time for you to move your money out of tech? Because you've probably made a lot of money in tech in the last couple of months and years. Let's take it to our next guest joining us tonight, Hightower Chief Investment Strategist Stephanie Link. and Douglas C. Lane and Associates Managing Partner Surat Seti, both CNBC contributors, both superstars of the Halftime Report, and we appreciate you coming on. And I hate, Stephanie, talking about sectors. It's so boring, right? They're like, well, sell tech and buy energy. That's so broad that I guess unless you just own one or two ETFs, I'm not sure what investors are getting out of that.
Well, it's always about the stock picking and the alpha that you're creating based on the fundamental analysis. And that's what Surat and I both do on a regular basis. But I think it's important to have a diversified portfolio. And you have been seeing a broadening out, generally speaking, since November of last year. If you look at the S&P equal weighted index, it is actually up 22.5%. If you look at the S&P market cap weighted, which is very tech heavy, it's up 23.9. So you're really almost neck and neck. And that is actually encouraging. And I think a lot of that started happening and it has continued the momentum in non-tech, in non-growth, because you had pretty good earnings last quarter. In the fourth quarter, you had earnings that were just as good as tech in healthcare, in industrials, in financials. And so I think people and investors like me, like Surat, we were looking and saying, wow, the earnings are really good, these other sectors, and the multiples are half that of technology.
Surat, you agree?
I totally agree. And you know, Stephanie's point is, look, there are other places to play in the stock market. And for, you know, quite a period of time, it was the Fab 7, the Mag 4, whatever you want to call it. But if you look, and to your point, Brian, if you want to look at stocks, look at, you know, in energy, look at a company called Schlumberger, right? They have got earnings growth, a multiple that's below market multiple, global reach, and you get a very well kind of balance sheet dividend growing stock. You can look at commodities and you look at Freeport-McNamara or Tech Resources if you want to play copper. So there are other areas that have really good opportunity right now, and it's okay to take profits. And that's one of the things that, you know, we as investors have to do, have to have discipline and say, hey, these stocks have done really well. Where else are the other opportunities? Where can we partake so that our clients can actually make some money?
Just interviewed the CEO of SLB, Olivier Lepouche, when I was at CERAWeek. He was very, very bullish. Stephanie, you got any specific names that you like for our audience?
Well, I'll just pivot a little bit towards the industrials. You mentioned GE Vernova. So GE has spun out GE Healthcare and now their power and wind business, Vernova. And actually, I added to that position last week. We got it. It was spun out last Tuesday. And in 3 days, it was down 14%. And this is a company that supplies 30% of the global electricity in the world. And I love spins, as you know, because spins usually work not only for the company that's spinning out, but also for SpinCo, because you can focus, the companies can focus on each separate businesses, investing, growing, improving margins. And I think that's exactly what GE Vernova is going to do. I also like Quanta Services. We haven't upgraded the grid in forever, and we need to. And I think that is, they're one of the number one players. And so I like the industrial space a lot, just as much as energy, but there are some great plays out there to be had.
It's amazing. If you want to have the data center, you've got to actually, A, make the power, which is GE Vernova. Imagine what that stock could do if it had a better name. And B, get the power. What do you drive? I drive a Buick Vernova. Fantastic. Anyway, get the power to the data center, which is what Quanta does. Speaking of power or lack of, Surat, I live in New Jersey, live in Central Jersey, got a lot of friends that work at J&J. They always coming up to me, what's wrong with our stock? I tell them, ask Surat Seti, you like J&J. It hasn't done squat in 3 years, but maybe that's why you want to own it.
It hasn't, and it's got a, you know, 15 multiple with a 3% dividend yield that's growing. And look, if you're looking for short-term catalysts, you have to say that, you know, they're going to spin off their businesses. They've got a great product pipeline. It's one of those stocks that's been ignored. It's a AAA balance sheet. And I think, you know, if you stick with it, you get earnings growth to 5 to 7% with a 3% dividend yield. Brian, I'll take an 8 to 10% grower any day. So I think the base of where you are now and the amount of products that a J&J has, especially when they do the spin, to Stephanie's point, you're going to see two different companies. And I think the opportunity is going to be there for investors.
And there's another one of those like made up, some consultant was paid millions to make up the name of the spinoff as well. I don't know where, it's like Wordle, like they're running out of words. There's plenty of good names out there. Surat, Stephanie Link, thank you very much. All right.
Thank you, Brian.
You're very welcome. Speaking of the Magnificent Seven, Tomorrow at 8:30 a.m., an exclusive interview with Amazon CEO Andy Jassy live on Squawk Box. Talk about the state of the consumer, their investments in AI, and so, so much more. All right, on deck, unnerving. That's how one analyst is describing a key Boeing supplier hire. It's kind of a weird story around Boeing. You're going to hear it, and former CEO of United will be up with it next. Time for your daily RBI. And today, let's dive in on brands, specifically the fastest growing brands in America. And this is a pretty cool and delicious list. Yelp built the list. They used rankings and metrics such as new locations, consumer interest, and search volume on their site and app. Restaurants dominated the full list, making up 23 of the 50 slots for fastest growing brands. So we're hungry. It's 7:27. So let's stay on the food story. Here are your top five fastest growing food and food related brands in all the land. Wawa. If you know, you know. A Pennsylvania-based convenience store and gas chain with a rabid fan base coming in at number five. And yes, they have plenty of food. Fourth fastest, Habit Burger Grill. Just went to one. Got to admit it was tasty. And by the way, it was also packed. Number three, Longhorn Steakhouse. Our producer Taylor tells us there's nothing like an outlaw ribeye. I don't know what that means, but that's what he told me to say. Number two is new to us. It's called Scooter's Coffee. It was founded by a couple in Nebraska. Apparently, it's really taken off. Maybe we should get Scooter's on the show. Let's reach out. Scooter's, if you're listening, call in, but just not right now. The fastest growing food brand, though, in America, no surprise. That is Cava. It's a Mediterranean fast casual spot. Some people call it the Yiddo of Chipotle's. Actually, I just made that up. But Cava added 72 new locations last year, and it's gotten a lot of good reviews on Yelp. Investors, by the way, they also love it. Shares are up 67% since going public last year, and are already up nearly 50% this year. Cava, number one, fastest growing food brand in America, and making money, random but interesting. All right, now to an interesting and frankly kind of head-turning story. It involves a relatively little-known company called Hexcel Corp and what an analyst calls a, quote, unnerving new hire. Now, Hexcel is a materials company. It is also one of Boeing's key suppliers. They just named their new CEO. His name is Tom Gentile. In a new note today, a Truist securities analyst said of the hiring is one of the more curious moves we have seen. Well, why? Well, Tom Gentile is the former CEO of Spirit Aerosystems. Does that sound familiar? Well, Spirit is a massive Boeing supplier. They build the fuselages, and they were, of course, found at fault for some of the company's quality issues, according to an FAA audit. Gentile resigned as CEO from Spirit Aerosystems last September, and now he was just hired at Hexcel, another big Boeing supplier. Investors, they didn't like it. Hexcel stock fell 12% today. Kind of a curious hire. What does it say about the ongoing mess in aerospace? Let's bring in CNBC contributor and former United Airlines CEO Oscar Munoz. Oscar, what do you make of this hire?
When the street calls things unnerving or curious, you have an issue for sure. You don't know how long this conversation has been going on with Gentile and Hexcel, and it is, the market clearly has reacted in a way that I think represents most of us thinking about this. But at the root of all of this is the ongoing drama of Boeing and what its plans or lack of plans are going forward. And that drama is just continues to expand into third derivative levels of the aerospace system. You just said, oh my God, what's wrong with aerospace? And I'm not sure there's anything wrong with aerospace. There's issues, obviously, clearly at Boeing. But for Boeing, this move would maybe have raised some eyebrows, but it wouldn't have been front page news. And you and I certainly wouldn't be talking about it on TV.
No, and it's kind of like sports, right, Oscar? I don't know if you're a sports fan, but a team loses a quarterback, and then they bring in, like, the old quarterback from the other team that let that same quarterback go. And you're like, isn't there somebody young that you could bring up? It makes me think there's a lack of talent. at the top levels of aerospace, at least on the manufacturing side?
You know, it's possibly there. I'm not in the room with the Hexcel board and what they've been, the current CEO has been there for quite some time. They've not had a lot of great success, but, you know, they've grown to a relatively, you know, mid-cap company. But there's clearly been decisions to move. What's most unsettling, not unsettling, just curious, is the fact that it's happening so quickly, right? And at this time. So what has to transpire for you to make this kind of decision effective almost immediately with all of the backdrop that we're seeing from Boeing and their broader aerospace? So we don't know what's happening behind that. But at the same time, you know, it is hope that anybody that leads these companies begins to bring an incredible focus back on safety and quality with plans that are transparent to us, the public.
Although I guess I could make the argument also, maybe it's like the coach instead of the quarterback, Oscar, where you know the playbook. And I don't exactly know how much, if at all, Hexcel and Spirit overlap in terms of parts. You probably do. But it's kind of like if somebody was pushed out of American Airlines and then they get picked up at Delta, you know all of American's secrets, right? I guess I could kind of understand the playbook.
Yeah, you know, Spirit and Hexcel are very different suppliers, right? I mean, they serve the industry, but what they provide is pretty much vastly different. There's relationships for sure with the big OEMs, with Boeing and Airbus, and so that's worth something. But again, the most curious part is that it's happening so quickly and in the midst of all of this that's going on. And so there's probably more information to be had there at some point in time. But, you know, from what I understand from people, Tom, you know, in his time there at Spirit, had some ups and downs. And what was the result of his leaving is still in question. And so for him to move into this role in this kind of time frame, I am at a loss for words, just like everyone else.
Yeah, and I loved your point at the top, Oscar, because you know, as a former CEO of a public company, the word curious is a really sneaky, powerful word on Wall Street, because it's like it means a lot more when you write it, right, as an analyst.
It ain't good.
Yeah, that was a curious move by the CEO. Like, you'd never want to hear that. Oscar Munoz, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
All right, coming up. Well, today's hot inflation deflate. President Biden's election chances or not. New data. And Frank Luntz after this. You see, they did that. Let's call this a Sully side down. If you're listening on the radio, they took my Sully side up graphic and then put in a down graphic because Paramount shareholders are not pleased, apparently, with merger talks with a company called Skydance Media. Some Paramount investors even writing letters to the board arguing Skydance's deal prioritizes Sherry Redstone, that's the daughter of the founder, over shareholder interests, one even calling it, quote, detrimental to the company's value. And according to the Wall Street Journal, four Paramount directors are now planning to step down over these discussions. Paramount stock down 12% so far this week due to investor pushback. Question is this, is Sherry Redstone pursuing a deal at the expense of maybe you, a Paramount shareholder? Let's talk about it tonight. It's a very interesting story. CNBC's Alex Sherman on set, as always, on Wednesdays. I know this is a little bit inside, I'd say baseball, but it's inside Hollywood. The bottom line is this, Sherry Redstone, very famous family name. Looks like she's trying to hose investors over her own
interests. So let's explain why people think this. This deal that she has concocted with Skydance Media over the past, I don't know, 5 months or so, is a weird one. It is not your conventional takeover. It is a two-part deal as constructed, where Skydance Media, which owns media and TV assets, but is smaller than Paramount Global, would first buy out National Amusements, which is Sherry Redstone's holding company, initially her father, Sumner Redstone. She would get $2 billion for that. That's a big premium, big win for Sherry Redstone. Then the media assets would merge with Paramount, but this would not be a takeover of the company. In fact, it would be dilutive to existing Paramount Global shareholders because new equity is going to be raised as part of this deal. So what the Paramount Global shareholders want, and what they've wanted for months, is a full takeover of the company.
Yes.
Which Apollo Global has apparently offered at $26, $27 billion. Now, we don't really know the contingencies of that deal. It may not even be fully funded at this point, but Apollo has a strong track record with being able to raise money. So investors have started to say, what are you doing, Paramount Global Special Committee? And today, the Wall Street Journal reported, which I've confirmed, that 3 of the 8 board members of the special committee plan on not running for re-election, which is soon for Paramount Global. So
that's
now
weird. That's weird.
Now this decision is going to be made theoretically by 3 people who are on their way out, or maybe not at all. So there, I think,
and apparently a guy from Squid Game, Rob Kleger, whoever that is, because he's on the witness protection right. program.
Rob Kleger is actually Sherry Redstone's attorney, so he's retiring. He's the one that isn't on the special committee, but his retirement also might be a signal that Sherry Redstone wants out.
Let me make a terrible metaphor to explain. It's very complicated, so I'm going to make a metaphor, and if this is totally wrong, please tell me, okay? Because I know you're direct, you'll be honest. There's a house for sale, okay? Everybody owns the house. There's a detached garage. The detached garage is owned by one person, okay, who also owns part of the house.
10%
They sell the house, except they think they sold the house. What they did is they just sold the detached garage. The house is still for sale, but doesn't have a garage.
Right.
And the one person who owned the garage got rich off the home sale.
Right. The owner of the garage controls the voting shares of the house.
So they got rich. The garage is gone, meaning this one part of
the
deal.
Yeah, the deal hasn't happened yet, but as constructed.
If it is, that's kind of how I'm trying to
frame. Correct. Your analogy's right.
Amazing.
That is the setup of this deal that investors are now starting to publicly say, don't do this. And the deal hasn't even been announced yet. And investors are starting to write public letters
saying, way the market sends a red flag. The market
Look at the shares.
Help, we're in the trunk, right? The market is saying that.
You know, the interesting thing today is that the market has hated this deal and the stock has gone down. Then the Wall Street Journal report comes out that these board members are stepping down, which may be a signal that there's cracks in the deal, and the stock went down again. So it may just be that likes chaos.
Okay, let's back it up.
Yep.
You do great merger reporting, break a lot of news. Why does anybody just want to buy the whole company? I know they got a ton of debt. I know that. And that's what you're going to say.
So that's part of it.
$15 billion, I think.
I think there's thinking, it's a little less than that now. Mm. I think part of the thinking is if nothing happens, if it's status quo, all we need to do is wait. And what's
the
catalyst
going to be?
Right, Top Gun 3.
Right?
Yes, Top Gun 3.
For
sure.
It's in a pilot nursing home.
Yes, I agreed. Look, there's a bull case and a bear case. Some people actually are believers in the strategy that Bob Bakish is running right now and Sherry Redstone saying, just give it time. Why would you sell now? Don't sell now. The strategy's working. The streaming losses are coming down. Give it another year or two. Investors will come back. There are great assets as part of this company.
Yeah.
Others are saying, just wait. There's no real growth catalyst
here.
Revenue's down. It'll go lower.
Alex, let's just be honest with each other. Sherry Redstone, if I stood to make $2 billion by selling that detached garage, and I'm just going to say, I probably, I'm not sure I would say no.
And
even if I can't, the other members of the house,
there's
got to figure
reason.
It out. But
there's a reason she's saying
she's
yes.
Gonna get, she's already rich. She's going to get really, really rich.
And from a source very close to her told me that what she said to the board was basically, find me a better deal and I'll do it. And you weren't able to find me one, so I'm going forward with this one.
Laid it out. It's a Hollywood intrigue. By the way, the Redstone family has been providing Hollywood intrigue for like 60 years.
Yeah, sure has.
Right. Since Sumner, her dad, held a burning building. He held on for dear life.
Yeah, Sumner was his own character.
Amazing.
Sherry doesn't is a little different.
All right, Alex Sherman, thank you. All right, let's get down to our quicker than the ticker, all the best of the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. Inflation Nation, the post office looking to hike the price of stamps again. If approved, it would be the 7th price hike in just 3 years. A first-class stamp would cost 73 cents, up from 68 cents. Running for the gold and $50,000. Track and field will be the first sport to give cash payments to gold medal winners at the Paris Olympics this year. Facing off in Brazil, the NFL announcing the Green Bay Packers and Philadelphia Eagles will play the first ever regular season game in Sao Paulo. It will take place at Corinthians Soccer Arena in September. The winningest NCAA coach retiring after 45 years, Tara Vanderveer, head coach of Stanford's women's basketball team, retiring with a whopping 1,216 victories, surpassing Duke's Coach K. From one goat to another, Jeffrey, a real goat, somehow escaped from an animal shelter and found himself teetering over a ledge on a bridge in Missouri. Thankfully, Jeffrey is now back on solid ground. Coming up, looking to make a little green from the greens? A former pro golfer joins us on who's best positioned to win this year's Masters.
Bonus TNT for you right now and some video just happening. A state dinner honoring Japan's prime minister is just getting underway at the White House. And we only mentioned that because some very big titans of bit. Look at that. That is Fed Chair Jay Powell walking in to the dinner. I bet you he's going to have a good time tonight. That is Jeff Bezos coming in with his wife. Look at that. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, founded a company called Jamie Dimon on the red carpet. There's Apple CEO Tim Cook coming in as well. Who else is coming in? This is literally all just happening. There we go. We've got to Arvind Krishna, who's a CEO of IBM. Oh, Masayoshi Son. I'm going off memory here. That is the founder and super billionaire of SoftBank. Hey, there's Larry Fink. Oh, that's right. I'm not there. And look at that. The fellow you know well, been on this program many times. That is the UAW's Sean Fain coming off their big contract win as well. No idea who that is. There's Jay Powell. So we're obviously rerunning the same video. Look at Powell, Tim Cook, Jeff Bezos, Sean Fain, Masayoshi's son. Apparently, by the way, dinner, dry aged ribeye, blistered with shishito pepper and shishito pepper butter, among other dishes on the menu. God, we're so hungry. It sounds so good. All right, meantime, the March inflation report. How about that for a segue? Coming in hotter than expected, rising 3.5% on an annual basis last month. And as inflation is on the rise again, could it impact the president's reelection chances? Because the president, well, he's been steadily rising in most of the polls. And in fact, on an aggregate of polls, he is now in the lead. Take it for what you will. If it's just him versus Trump, not putting in third-party candidates, a new poll from Reuters, got a four-point lead. Back in March, he held just a one-point lead. And when it comes to betting odds on who will win the race, President Biden is faring a little bit better. On Predictit, the betting market, he is now at 51 cents, basically 51%, while former President Trump at 46 cents. After today's inflation report, the odds were actually unchanged. President trying to be on the campaign trail, doing some choreographed presentations, for lack of a better term. And apparently some in his inner circle are sounding the alarm. Former Biden chief of staff Ron Klain, arguably maybe the man most close to the president, apparently put out an internal memo that the Biden administration, his boss, the president, is putting too much attention on things like big picture bridge things and not enough time on real world economy. Let's talk about it now with Frank Luntz, pollster, author, and otherwise very knowledgeable guy. I think this by the way, this memo, apparently Klain's memo, because you don't really criticize the president, he kind of did, making its way around. But I think Mr. Klain has a point, right, to the president. Yeah, it's nice to go to a bridge in Wisconsin that no one's ever heard of, but you need to be talking, I think, about why the heck are grocery prices still so high?
Exactly. It's the F squared, H squared equation, food and fuel, housing and healthcare. And if those are climbing, then every American, not just those who are at the forefront of the economy, everyone's affected by it. Everyone's angry about it. Now add to it the number two issue, and in some polls it's become the number one issue, immigration, chaos at the border, violence in our cities. You take those two, these are quality of life issues, standard of living issues, and they affect the average American no matter what state you're in. And that's why I see Klain's point. And if I were advising the president right now, I'd be focused on affordability more than anything else.
And have you folk noticed this narrative shift that is happening about the border crisis? Because, listen, immigration writ large, we know America needs it. It's what we're built on. Immigrants built this country. We're all immigrants. Everybody, we get that. But we're talking about two different types of immigration. And there's now this sort of, I'm seeing it, a kind of a spin from the White House where they're saying basically, oh, well, no, border crisis, not bad. Border crisis is good because it's providing us a lot of low cost labor, which I don't know how to read that. I kind of feels gross, to be honest with you. But it's happening. That spin, that shift is occurring, Frank.
Well, this show is watched by a lot of CEOs.
Thank you.
And I want to correct two misconceptions that they may have. Number one, don't call it inflation. Nobody talks about inflation except on shows on CNBC. The average American talks about affordability. If they can't afford the meat they want to have, they can't afford to fill up their car with gas, they can't get the house they want, it's affordability. And number two, in terms of immigration, it's the idea of security, maintaining rule of law. It is an assumption in America that we can control our borders, that we can have safe streets, safe neighborhoods. And if that is undercut in any way, that's going to punish the president. Yeah. CEOs need to communicate the same way the politicians do. Get the language correct.
Yeah, and get the math correct. We've seen a little bit of weird math lately. Frank Luntz, always love having you on, Frank. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, coming up after the break, we're talking the Masters, and you got your betting pool ready? Well, is there a dark horse? Yeah, maybe two. We got the names next. Hello, friends. The Masters tees off tomorrow at Augusta National, which is good news for bettors who are looking for some action after March Madness. Also, by the way, just good news for golf fans. Now, at 4-1, Scottie Scheffler is the favorite to win. Rory McIlroy and last year's champion Jon Rahm will follow. Xander Schauffele and Brooks Koepka round out the top five, but there may be some people lurking that you don't know. Let's bring in Golf Channel analyst Aaron Oberholzer, who played three times at the Masters. Is this Aaron, welcome, by the way. Is this Scottie's tournament to lose and everybody else is just following along?
That's a great question. I would say yes. If we weren't going to get the weather that we're going to get in the next couple of days, then I think that kind of throws a wrench into this whole thing, is that we don't know the unpredictability of high winds that we're supposed to get and a lot of rain yet tomorrow, and then high winds tomorrow as well as as well as Friday. We don't really know. This kind of throws everything out of whack for something for a guy that I picked. Basically, I was on a podcast on Sunday night, and the guy asked, a friend of mine asked me, hey, so where's Scheffler going to be come Sunday? And I said, well, one of two places. He's going to have a 5-shot lead come Sunday morning when he rolls to that tee, or with 9 holes to go, he's going to be right there in the lead or within in 2 of the lead going to that back 9. That's how good he's playing. That's if he's not playing all that. He's playing.
Is there like a good wind guy? I don't know enough about golf to ask a smart question. Aaron,
there's a few. Matt Fitzpatrick's a good bad weather player. Shane Lowry's a good bad weather player. Those guys have some experience around Augusta National. I went off the radar a little bit more than that. And I went fairly far off the radar. If you really want some value with your picks, I like Sahith Theegala. I think he's having a very good year. But also Sahith is a very good bad weather player, and he's got all the shots required around Augusta National. He's kind of an artist. He can move the ball left to right, right to left. He can hit it high. He can hit it low. And he's got a very good short game. So he's only played here once, which this place loves institutional knowledge. They like golfers that have played here before because of the nuances of this golf course. But I do think Sahith Theegala has the chops to get it done in bad weather and to be there come the weekend.
In 10 seconds, who is Ludvig Åberg and why could he also win?
Well, he is the 9th ranked player in the world, and he's a rookie. He's a rookie at the not only on the PGA Tour, but he's a rookie he's a rookie at majors. This is his first major, let alone his first Masters, but he is going to be a stud. And
Aaron,
a phenomenal striker and great head on shoulder.
The course marshal's taking us off. Aaron Oberholzer, appreciate it, folks. See you tomorrow night. Shark Tank's next.